This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with the co-authors of an article titled A People's History of the Egyptian Revolution.
The movement there, which began amassing opposition to the Mubarak regime, started 10 years ago and is by no means over.
Under the guise of humanitarian intervention, the U.S. and NATO are spending millions of dollars on a military operation in Libya.
Former Attorney General of the United States Ramsey Clark says not only is it a war, it's a war of aggression, the supreme crime in international law.
We'll talk with two attorneys who scored a recent victory protecting the privacy of protesters' online identities.
Finally, internet anonymous speech protected. Let's see more of these victories.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Egypt's uprising didn't suddenly happen overnight. There were a number of important antecedents to it. In the article, A People's History of the Egyptian Revolution, after Egypt and Israel signed the Camp David Accords in 1979, Egypt was rewarded with billions in U.S. military aid that paved the way for a neoliberal policy under Hosni Mubarak, which terribly undercut the standard of living of the Egyptian people. By the year 2000, the first signs of widespread opposition started in solidarity with the Second Palestinian Intifada. The protests centered around poverty, corruption, and the need for democracy. A second wave of mass opposition ignited in 2003 in response to the U.S. invasion of Iraq and Egypt's support for the war. Then, the April 6 movement arose in 2008, which featured protests against rising food costs and low wages. By 2010, social media and blogs were outlets for organizing and dissent. That brings us to where we are now, with elections being set in Egypt for November of this year, and Mubarak sitting in jail awaiting trial. We're joined by Left Turn magazine editor Rami El Amin and also Montreal activist Mustafa Henaway. We go first to Rami El Amin in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Rami, I read your excellent article, which is available online, A People's History of the Egyptian Revolution, and I was struck by your beginning thought, no matter how it unfolds, and it's still unfolding, the Egyptian Revolution will go down in history as one of the defining moments of the early 21st century, and I wanted to ask you what your thinking is behind making that judgment.
I mean, the main thing is that while the Tunisian Revolution that had preceded it was pretty significant, and the main thing that ignited the main event that sort of spurred the Egyptian Revolution. The Egyptian Revolution was much more significant in its because of the significance of Egypt politically, militarily, and economically in the Middle East and in a region which right now is in the crosshairs of the U.S. and U.S. imperialism and the war on terror. Maybe some people have said that's quite a grandiose statement to make, but the coming together of the war on terror with this Arab uprisings throughout the Middle East at this time are very significant in terms of historically which direction things can go in the world. While it's still unfolding, the direction that this revolution go can transform the Middle East significantly and loosen, dislodge the sort of U.S. stranglehold, the U.S. military stranglehold the U.S. has had on the Middle East at this critical time and its control of oil.
Let's talk about how the events of January and February of this year unfolded in Egypt, because there were antecedents to it. It didn't come out of nowhere. What were the various groups and issues that led up to the great events in January and February?
Yeah, that's important, I think, especially for activists here and people who realize that this didn't just happen out of nowhere. And even if sometimes it feels like things are very difficult. I mean, you look back at basically 10 years previous to the revolution is when things started in very small in Egypt, mainly around the outbreak of the Palestinian Intifada in 2000. basically solidarity protests in Egypt in support of the Palestinian Intifada. You know, there were big demonstrations, but it was very much up and down. There would be big demonstrations, and there would be periods very little going on. And this continued through the decade with the Gulf War, protests against the Gulf War and the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
That was in 2003. And then did it evolve into protests about domestic issues in Egypt itself?
Yeah, so after the Gulf War protests, people came together around this coalition called Kefaya, which is means enough. Essentially, while they were working on sort of international issues, they the main thing they came together around was domestic issues of the corruption and massive disparities in wealth that were, I mean, always a part of Egyptian society, but had grown tremendously in the past 10 to 15 years. That coalition is really the basis for which a lot of the youth organizers, the revolutionary youth that spearheaded the January 25th revolution this year, come out of.
Were there protests in Egypt and strikes because of the huge increase in the cost of food that developed really from a failure of the wheat crop in Russia, and the price of food just surged in Egypt? And what happened there in 2008? Tell us.
Yeah, exactly. So 2008, there was a movement by a lot of these youth groups to support workers who had been protesting in the sort of textile center of Mahalla in Egypt and in the Delta. This area is known for, has a long history of militant workers and strikes. It wasn't 2008, while they led the sort of protests against the rise in food prices, it spread very quickly to a number of other cities, became known as the Mahalla Intifada.
And that was in April of 2008, and that's the April 6th movement that we're talking about then. Well, it came to a boil. There was a turning point on February 2nd when Mubarak unleashed his thugs against the demonstrators. And I wanted to talk about that too, because I'm sure that the people were afraid, but they nonetheless went up against forces of repression on camelback, on horseback, with knives, and stood up to him. And I think that was the turning point. And I wanted to see whether you agree with me and explain what your view was on that.
Yeah, that definitely was one of the main turning points. I think before that, to me, one of the most moving scenes was actually on January 28th. There was a protest, sort of the main next protest that was called after the 25th. And it was on a Friday, and so the Friday protests draw a lot more people. Was basically a face-off on the Kasr al-Nir bridge leading into Cairo, and thousands of protesters basically battled with thousands of security forces. And there's some incredible footage of it where basically they would go back and forth. I mean, the police were like firing off tear gas like there was no tomorrow, and just attack, you know, driving through the protesters with their trucks, and then they used water cannons. And the protesters were really smart. In certain points, they would just stop and start praying. And so, you know, you had these scenes that were reminiscent of, like, you know, the civil rights movement in the U.S. You know, these people were being attacked, and they were standing there. So to me, you know, that on the 28th was really, you know, a very sort of pivotal time. But definitely then the attacks that Mubarak's thugs and others were on the camelback and horses and attacking, the sort of just thuggery that happened.
Well, we've been speaking with Rami El Amin. We'll link up with minarets in Temecula on our website, lawanddisorder.org. But Rami, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
We're joined by Montreal activist Mustafa Henaway.
Mustafa Henaway, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having me on Law and Disorder this week. A very timely actual discussion as Mubarak's trial begins today.
Before we get into the specifics of that, can you give us some background on your Solidarity Collective?
Tudamin is a collective that formed in 2005, just before the war in Lebanon had begun in July 2006, to work with Palestinian refugees in Lebanon and sort of to highlight social justice movements in the Arab world, particularly at Lebanon at that time, and then after the war in Lebanon took place in 2006, where Israel had killed over 1,300 Lebanese civilians, we began to become more and more involved in the growing campaign around boycott, divestment, and sanctions based on the international campaign on the 2005 July 9th, calling for an end to Israeli apartheid through ending of the occupation, the full right of return of Palestinian refugees, and sort of equality for Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel on those three demands. And we've been participating in that campaign for the past 5 years. And also in the past year, we've been really working with different communities and different movements across the Arab world, showing solidarity and organizing demonstrations, events around the revolutions in Egypt, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Bahrain. So we've been very active, both in terms of Palestine solidarity and also what's taking place in the Arab world and the Middle East.
Mustafa, let me ask you about the upcoming Mubarak trial. But before we talk about that, it was just remarkable that in the course of less than 3 weeks, the Egyptian people were to go from the point of being under the thumb of that terribly repressive regime to having Mubarak in jail. And now he's on trial for corruption. But what I wanted to ask you before we talk about the trial is, who's in power in Egypt now? And in your opinion, have things really changed?
Right now, who's in power is called the SCAF, or the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces. And the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces is the chief of staff of the Egyptian military, Egyptian Navy, and Egyptian Air Forces. And the SCAF had taken power, part of an agreement, by the end of the revolution with Mubarak and his cabinet. And the reason why the military intervened at that point to caretake the Egyptian state until there was elections was essentially that the military has always been the backbone of the Egyptian state since 1952, whether there's a civilian government, in terms of or a fake civilian government, such as Mubarak or Mubarak's cabinet, particularly in 2004 when his son Gamal Mubarak really entered the political arena and setting up the new cabinet and becoming the policy head of the policy committee for the National Democratic Party. The military made a decision that sort of the new ruling elite in Egypt under Gamal Mubarak had to go.
They made that decision, and he went. And if he's healthy enough, he may even stand trial for corruption. In the meantime, there are elections scheduled in September. And are there any parties that are putting forward a program for real basic social change? Or do you think that it'll be more of the same, even though there's kind of a parliamentary facade on the government?
In terms of the elections, they've actually been pushed back to November now. And you have many political actors sort of entering the arena. You have multiple parties being set up that are really making demands for real social change. So what you have is progressive parties such as the Popular Alliance, which is a grouping of leftists and different progressive movements.
Mustafa, what demands is that party making?
That party is making demands for a raise in the minimum wage, independent trade unions, to Egypt to remain a secular state, basic employment and subsidies for the Egyptian population. And so, and really an end to the emergency laws. I mean, these are all basic things that most of the movements are actually demanding for a better Egypt. And then you also have what's called the Workers' Democratic Party, which is another party that's really more based in sort of the Egyptian working class, sort of organized labor or new organized labor, because trade unions have always existed, but they've actually been under state control since the 50s. So they've actually been making demands for independent trade unions from the Egyptian state.
In a nutshell, if you were going to draw the lessons from the Egyptian struggle for those of us here in North America, what would you say?
We can't turn back. That, you know, that at some point we have to go forward. And I think in making that leap forward and having that faith, I think people begin to think that these moments are actually possible. And we saw that in Wisconsin briefly, but people didn't turn away after the first day. people said, no, we're going to stay. We're making our stand here. And actually more people came out.
Well, Mustafa Henaway, author of A People's History of the Egyptian Revolution, and which we'll link to on lawanddisorder.org. Mustafa, thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder.
No, thank you very much for having me on Law and Disorder, and hopefully we see a Tahrir moment in the U.S. very soon.
Hopefully
we
will.
Thanks very much, Mustafa.
Thank you.
Take it easy.
Thank you.
As many listeners know, the U.S. and NATO military operation in Libya is not a humanitarian intervention, but rather part of the global war and effort to militarize North Africa. The Chinese, for example, have sizable interests in Libya in the battle for oil. Meanwhile, the Gaddafi leadership has continued to function despite the NATO bombing campaign over the last 4 months and the loss of significant parts of the country. Congressman Cynthia McKinney recently returned from a fact-finding mission in Tripoli during a time of intense bombing. She has organized speakers to discuss how millions are spent in this military operation, while we're being told there are no funds available for domestic jobs, health care, and education. Ramsey Clark was among the speakers, and he has been following the U.S. and NATO involvement in brutal attempts to overthrow the Gaddafi government. Ramsey Clark was the former Attorney General under President Lyndon B. Johnson and was the first AG at the Justice Department to call for the elimination of the death penalty and all electronic surveillance. After he left the administration, he became an important critic of the Vietnam War and continued defending the rights of people worldwide, from Palestinians to Iraqis to anyone who found themselves on the repressive end of government action.
Attorney Ramsey Clark, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's very good to be here. Thank you.
Harry Reid gave a reason for the United States not declaring war on Libya, even though they're dropping bombs on that country, by saying that, well, the war is going to be over with very quickly, and therefore it's really not a war. It's quite disturbing to people like you and me and Heidi, who believe in the rule of law and international law, to hear this kind of thing. And I wanted to ask you just initially, what is the international law relating to U.S. actions with respect to Libya?
Well, I think the reality is a war of aggression, which the Nuremberg Charter and judgment defined as the supreme international crime. Because what we've done is used the appearance of growing civil war, you might say, of people rising up against their own government to wage a massive assault, really unrelated to their activities. I mean, the first places we started hitting were Tripoli, and they were nowhere near Tripoli, and we bombed the daylights out of it, and are still bombing the daylights out of it. I talked to people in Tripoli yesterday, and they think 1,000 have been killed in the last few days in heavy bombing. It's really, and it's spreading away from the compound. It's hitting areas all over the city. So the war of aggression is, it seems to be a strange thing, and the U.S. was able to, it didn't take much to twist the arms of particularly France and Italy, but NATO to come in and take over so we can stay in the background, considering our deep and lonely involvement in Iraq still and in Afghanistan. Interesting to note that people are still fleeing from Iraq to Syria because it's safer there. Well, all we see on our television, reading our newspapers, is how violent the situation is in Syria.
Yeah, that's really is ironic. The pretext for the United States participating in the bombing of Libya was the same pretext with respect to Yugoslavia, and that was humanitarian intervention. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, you know, the idea of humanitarian intervention is good, but it also contains danger, because what happens, obviously, is it's invoked selectively for places where we have interest in changing the regime or the government. If you go back to Rwanda and remember how outraged everybody was after, but nobody bothered to intervene at the time. French had troops there. We could have had troops there very quickly and saved the lives of perhaps hundreds of thousands of people. A clearer illustration is what's been happening for years in the eastern part of Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, where hundreds of thousands of people have died and are dying and have been killed by armed troops of Governor Rwanda and others. Nobody's bothered to intervene. I mean, the slaughter there far exceeds anything that's happened or could happen, for that matter, except for the Holocaust in Libya. So what you do is you selectively, where you want to go in anyway, you use humanitarian intervention as your justification. You could theoretically use that every place there are demonstrations in the Arab world right now.
Ramsey, I understand that Congresswoman McKinney recently returned from a fact-finding mission in Tripoli, and that she's been speaking out about the billions of dollars spent on this military operation. Given the economic crisis that this country is going through right now, why aren't more Congress people speaking out in opposition?
Well, you know, the poor Congress is defaulting on its responsibility and totally involved in partisan politics and issue politics, and the votes they think will be determined by other issues. They don't see the public as being concerned about military costs compared to the military budget, which in its totality exceeds the civilian budget, all the other expenditures of the United States government.
Yeah.
So they can gloss over it. And until we address the issue of U.S. military expenditures, our country, our government, will be a threat to peace in the world. We spend more on the military than the rest of the world combined, if you include not only our direct military expenses, but the foreign military aid, the guns we give to favored countries to kill other people. It's just almost impossible to think that the United States will curtail its foreign aggressions while its military expenditures are at the level they are. I mean, we still have tens of thousands of troops around the world from World War II, and we're developing new and dangerous weapons like the drones, which have as their ultimate purpose the ability to assassinate anybody on the earth, any place on earth, by punching a button in Washington or someplace Washington designates for button punching. I mean, we've got in the Pacific Ocean today 8 Trident II nuclear submarines on alert. The cost of that is enormous. Each one of them carries 140 to 145 nuclear warheads, any one of which can destroy the biggest city in the country and go beyond it. They have their largest warhead would create a crater with a 25-mile diameter, if you can believe it. Imagine that in New York or in Shanghai.
Let me get back, Ramsey Clark, get back to Libya. Gaddafi, certainly not a democratic figure, but nonetheless presided over a government that gave certain benefits to its citizens and, moreover, was cooperating with the United States. And what puzzles me is why did they seek to replace him?
Well, we've never liked Gaddafi, although it's pretty clear that his people support him, isn't it? They've resisted the might of the United States and NATO for months and months now. Hard to sleep at night in Tripoli and other places that are under direct attack by us. But we tolerated him for 40 years while he created in the Libyan society the highest standard of living in all of Africa, highest per capita income, highest levels of education, highest health care, got more public housing than they can use for their own citizens, and almost enough for all their foreign labor. Perhaps his success, but I think the main reasons fall into 3 categories. One is he doesn't submit to the will of the United States, which is intolerable. 2 is that the country possesses wealthy and high-quality oil reserves that we've been excluded to a greater extent than we like to be, because we like to have the biggest piece of pie. And the 3rd is his support for unity in Africa, which I think we consider a threat to a lot of our interests. And you look at Africa, all the places, I mean sub-Saharan Africa primarily, all the places on earth is dying. It's not just conditions from weather temporarily in East Africa, but every place you go, and the political structure is crumbling. You take countries like Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire, which we thought were stable going back 50 years to Kwame Nkrumah. It hadn't occurred to me 10 years ago that there was a likelihood that things would fall apart in West Africa, but the chaos seems to be spreading, and we seem to prefer it. Those are the main reasons, as far as I can tell.
Well, talk to us, Ramsey Clark, about the nature of the, quote, rebel forces in Libya. Who are these people? What do they represent? What do they want? What's their relationship to the United States?
It's a diverse group that doesn't always even know each other and certainly doesn't always like each other. It's primarily tribal groups and regional groups. It came out of Benghazi. I think people have always looked at the oil just south of them and a little bit west of them and thought, why don't we have all that for ourselves? When you look at our contact group and its reports, which is just eight people over there, seem to have some access to some of the leadership, if you can tell who a leader is, because these little militias pop up from time to time with people who see some local gain from it. And we can't even clarify a mystery like who and why and how the highest military commander in the coalition was murdered. We're trying to pull them together, obviously, but our main is to get rid of Gaddafi, and we took out all of his planes pretty quickly, which is easy to do, and it's easy to hit his armor. There's not many bushes to hide behind over there, and if his armor goes out, we can hit him, knock him out pretty well, which really reduces the ability of his military to fight. But they're on the offensive in a number of places, and they've held their own against the might of the United States and West Europe for months and months. You compare what they've done with the collapse of Egypt on their east boundary and Tunisia on their west, where there was obviously no popular support for Mubarak or Ben Ali, the two leaders of those two countries. In fact, the people were overjoyed to see him go. But here you see, in the face of all this bombing and military power and threat, the people standing with Gaddafi in the majority of the big cities.
Ramsey, if we assassinate Gaddafi, what do you think the repercussions will be for us politically?
Well, if we did it outright and could be described as an assassination, after all, the first days of bombing were an assassination attempt, I think, by any rational analysis. We were trying to kill him. It's the same compound that we hit in 1986. I went over there. Immediately, I had calls from people in hospitals, families of people who were in hospitals in Switzerland. I think it's Lucerne. I thought Geneva, but I think it's Lucerne, and also in Vienna. Hundreds, primarily burn cases that they couldn't handle in the hospital. This is after the 86 raid. They killed hundreds of people, despite the fact that our Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberg, said it was impossible that anybody had been killed, destroyed, or didn't destroy, but badly damaged four embassies in the heart of Tripoli. This time we were hitting the same compound. The office building that we saw in the early days that we were bombing was the same one we bombed in 86. We hit his tent, we hit his home, which hadn't been rebuilt. That time we came off the sea. Those planes flew from Lackenheath Air Force Base. They didn't have overflight permission from any country in Western Europe. They had to go clear around the Iberian Peninsula and come in through Straits of Gibraltar, and they came 100 feet off the sea. And the first planes hit his home, his office, the tent that he had out in the field there, because he likes to remember his Bedouin days, probably more than anything else. Then we hit generously Benghazi, particularly the naval facilities and military facilities there. But we bombed downtown Tripoli. We killed hundreds of people. And they finally paid. The hypocrisy of it is incredible. I sued here for 340 claimants, I think it was, and got sanctioned for it by the Court of Appeals. The district court had declined to, but they finally paid. We agreed to pay, without admitting liability, $300 million that the people killed in 1986 by our bombing, if you can believe it, what a turnaround. But we kind of covered it up by taking it out of the money that was set aside for the people who were had sued Libya for Pan Am 103 and things like that. They got about $1 billion in the population of, that is, the claimants of people killed in Tripoli and Benghazi in 1986. We got about $300 million out of that fund.
Ramsey, you were trying to get over to Libya a couple of weeks ago, and it was just impossible. What was the reasons you were trying to get there, and do you have plans to try to get there again?
Yeah, I'm hoping to get there. And it's going to be about 10 days before I can try to get there, but I think it's very important to have as much presence there as we can to see what's going on. I think Cynthia McKinney's visit there and her broadcast from there were enormously helpful, as are her many speeches around the country now. She was here up at Riverside Church last Saturday, and a week ago Sunday I was up there with her too. I went down to Atlanta to speak with her the week before that. But she's had a tour that's probably exceeding 25, 30 cities by now. And we need more and more of that. We need people on the streets too. There's this, what we hope will be a huge rally coming up this weekend in Harlem. And Cynthia had a meeting on 125th Street in the theater there just several weeks ago, as well as one at Riverside Church last Saturday.
Before we thank you and say goodbye, do you have any further thoughts that you want to share with our audience?
Well, I think the two thoughts are our people have to organize and rise up. I don't think we're going to get anything accomplished in terms of peace or reduction of U.S. militarism except by an enormous demand of the people. You know, there's a pretty easy solution to me, and that is the vast reduction of our military spending. We could cut our spending 90%, in my opinion, military spending, and be safer, not be engaged in all these interventions, and which we can't handle anymore anyway. I mean, look how long we've been in Afghanistan, and the situation, the violence is rising again in Iraq after 20 years after the Gulf War and 8 years after shock and awe when we sent 150,000 troops in there and occupied the country for years, and more violence now than last year and growing. Places out of control. So we've got to tend to home affairs and be good neighbors and friends of the world, and we can take that 90% we save, take care of our own folks and health and education and housing and all the things we need, and then foreign aid. Lots of foreign aid to countries in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere where people are starving.
Ramsey Clark, our profound respect and affection for you. Thank you for being on Law & Disorder, and thank you very much for the good work you do every day. Thank you, Ramsey.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be with you all.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Sunday service at the Mount Hope Baptist Church in Lansing, Michigan, members of the queer rights group Bash Back disrupted the service to protest anti-gay policies. Months later, the church and the Alliance Defense Fund, a reactionary Christian nonprofit, sued Bash Back and 15 named activists under the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. The church and the defense fund subpoenaed identifying information in an attempt to find out who the protesters were. RiseUp.net, a provider of online communication tools for individuals and groups working for social change, was the only email provider to challenge the subpoenas. A federal judge ruled that RiseUp.net did not have to turn over the records, finding that the user's First Amendment right to speak anonymously online outweighs Mount Hope's right to discovery. National Lawyers Guild members Larry Hildes of Bellingham, Washington, Devin Theriot Orr of Seattle, and Mark Snyderman of Indiana successfully defended several activists who received subpoenas. Once again, this shows how readily corporations share private personal data on activists with the government and other private entities. We're joined today by attorneys Larry Hildes and Devin Theriot Orr, who worked on the case. Welcome, Larry, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
We know that Bashback activists received subpoenas and that you successfully fought those. Can you give us a brief background of the case?
Sure. The underlying Michigan case, Bashback did a demonstration at a particularly obnoxious fundamentalist church in Lansing, Michigan. They do actions and activities. They're mostly trans, mostly youth, drawing attention to homophobia and bigotry against trans folks. And this church is particularly virulent with their ministry aimed at turning gay people straight, is always very successful.
Right.
And well, if you pray hard enough,
it's not the way
works.
I would want to make a living. For
no.
Both political reasons as well as for success, so-called, quote, success.
Absolutely. So they did a legal picket outside, and the church has a big sign saying, "All welcome." They went in and tried to pass out leaflets, threw some leaflets up to the balcony. We were joking that the worst threat they were is to cause paper cuts. Two women ran to the front of the sanctuary and kissed each other at the altar. That was as dangerous and scary as this got. Mount Hope Baptist Church called the police, who were not particularly progressive, it's Lansing, Michigan, showed up and said, "There's no criminal activity here. We can't arrest anyone. They're not doing anything," and left.
Great. Case closed.
You would think. The Alliance Defense Fund, which I had not heard of before, but have certainly heard of now, huge fundamentalist law firm and fundraising empire in Scottsdale, Arizona, contacted the church and said, "We'll take on your case," apparently for free, and apparently paying all the expenses, and sued these folks under the FACE Act, the Access to Clinic Act, which some Republicans stuck in a rider, including disruption of church services as a coming under the act. None of these folks have any money. Most of them had not been there before and were never going to go there again. But they sued them and ultimately settled for $2,500 and a consent decree that they would never disrupt a religious service anywhere in the United States ever again.
Wow.
Their counsel advised them not to take the settlement.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I don't think it's enforceable at all constitutionally. In the meantime, they went on a witch hunt to find everyone connected with Bashback in any way. And they went to Yahoo and subpoenaed records from listservs on Yahoo. And Yahoo, without telling anybody, gave them what they wanted. And the records then showed up in discovery. That was the only way they knew about it. Then they went after RiseUp, and RiseUp prides themselves on two things. They're an internet voice for the left, and they protect the privacy of their subscribers very, very strictly and very ardently. Their in-house counsel is Devin Theriot Orr, who's a member of the collective of RiseUp. He stepped in to represent RiseUp, sent the ADF a letter explaining why they weren't entitled to this information, citing them some case law. They ignored it and filed a motion to compel under the subpoena. He contacted me to represent an objector, one of the subscribers to the list, so we would have first-party standing, since RiseUp itself only has third-party standing on behalf of its subscribers. He outlined all the internet case law And there is some good law. And I took on the task of explaining why this violates freedom of association and cited all the civil rights cases, NAACP v. Alabama, all of those, Claiborne Hardware, and all of those cases.
Talk to us about that, just for our listeners' benefit. When you talk about freedom of association, why is that important, and what is the law in that?
The law is that members of political organizations do not have to disclose their membership lists. They don't have to disclose who they're in communication with, because in order to have dissent, people have to be protected from retaliation. This has been a major area of practice that my office is engaged in, that we've engaged in, and it comes up constantly. Every time we sue the police on behalf of people at a demonstration, they want to know who the group was, how they organized, who attends their meetings. In at least one case, we've actually had military spies in these meetings finding out who people are. Then they can retaliate against these people in terms of their work, in terms of their personal safety, in terms of their freedom. Lots of ways that the government, and in this case, the Alliance Defense Fund, can really harass these people. And in order to engage in free speech, you have to at least have some degree of security and safety that your privacy is going to be protected. Otherwise, it so chills the climate that very few people are going to be willing to take that risk. That's exactly what the ADF wanted to do, was to scare anybody with any connection to Bashback out of ever saying anything ever again against the church.
And Larry, the Supreme Court has held in years recent that internet speech is afforded full First Amendment protection, correct?
Absolutely. Devin cited To the March, which is one of the key cases, which it turns out he did.
What's the key case? Say it again.
The number to the Mart.
To the Mart.
It was an internet company. Apparently, it's a very strange.
But anyway, now I have a good story about the church service disruption, so-called disruption. I represented in the 70s a number of priests and nuns who were fighting against the war. And a group of them, I can't remember which ones, whether it was Berrigans or Barrickers or whatever, which nuns went into the church. But they went into St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue, you know, the most prestigious, huge Catholic cathedral in New York. I mean, giant. You look like an ant when you're in there. And the women threw themselves down in the middle aisle, and they started praying to end the war in Vietnam. And the whole service, of course, came to a close, and everybody's looking, what's going on? And they got arrested, and the Catholic Church insisted at that point on going forward with the prosecution. And so I go to court with my spouse at the time, who's a lawyer now, Margaret Ratner, counselor. And yet the defense we took was that they were engaging in First Amendment-protected religious right to practice religion in their own way. The Catholic Church had its way of doing it, whoever was there, but they were also praying in a space that you could walk into in a public way, and they had a First Amendment-protected right to pray in the manner in which they did. And we won.
You won?
So, yeah, we won.
That's amazing.
Wow. Yeah, we won. The judge basically dismissed the case.
What, you have a Jewish judge?
I don't know. So that would be another defense for your clients out there.
That they were practicing their
practicing their religion.
Yeah, why can't they do it on somebody else's property? That's the defense.
Anyway.
Larry, were you surprised at the judge's finding?
We were and we weren't. He's a judge, Richard Jones, the Western District of Washington, is well known as a First Amendment scholar. He's actually well known as a scholar in general. He's meticulous. And we had an idea before the hearing. We got into the hearing, and the night before, his law clerk had sent a list of questions to everybody that the judge would be addressing. I had one question to answer. Devin had one question to answer. The ADF had 2.5 pages. Because there is a fair amount of case law. You cannot go after the membership list, as we already talked about. They insisted they weren't. They just want to know everybody whose name was associated with the group so they could find the people who were actually at the demonstration. And there's a fair amount of case law that says that you cannot use names and information about people on the internet in order to prosecute them or in order to sue them. And they were actually doing both of those things. They tried to argue that they weren't. So we were simply arguing. It was easier for us in some ways because we're arguing straight First Amendment. This is protected. Everyone has a right to be on these listservs. They don't have to give their names. The case that's actually been started as bad, the one that allowed some investigation in a commercial speech setting for who was criticizing a company, which turned out to be internal people, who were sued for defamation, actually specifies when you can and when you can't go after people, and it's pretty narrow. So we were able to differentiate it. We had an idea. ADF's attorney called in sick, basically, and appeared by phone. She had been briefing like crazy, and the day before the hearing announced that she had gone through surgery the week before when she was in the middle of doing her pleadings, and the doctor had ordered her not to fly. So I think they had some inkling of what was coming, too. So they appeared by phone. When they were in the midst of arguing that they didn't really want this information to get the names of people to add to the lawsuit, especially since the suit was winding down and discovery was closed, or was closing within 2 days, they wanted the names so they could investigate those people and depose those people to get the names of people who might have been at the demonstration. They were arguing something very tangential, and then they turned around later and said no, they really just wanted the names to add defendants, and it added a defendant from the information they got from Yahoo. The victory is that there is a First Amendment right to be on a listserv for a group, even a group that does actions that could be seen as civil disobedience or otherwise illegal, and your information is still protected and private, and the freedom of association privilege goes to that, so that you have an absolute privilege to be involved in political organizing without fear of being sued because the group does something that you weren't involved in or were involved in. Also want to note, we were awarded by the court last Thursday $28,000 in fees.
Whoa.
I was awarded $17,500. Devin was awarded about $11,000. Yesterday, they put up a bond and announced that they were going to appeal. And it turns out the church doesn't even know they lost this. The ADF is putting up the bond and doing the appeal, and they apparently haven't even notified the church.
Great job you did.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for
Thanks,
having
Larry.
Me.
Thanks, Larry. Talk to you soon.
Thank you,
okay. Bye-bye. Devin, we've spoken with your colleague, Larry Hildes, and who represented individuals from Bashback, and we understand that you were the attorney for RiseUp.net. Can
That's
you tell
right.
us how you got involved in the case?
We received a subpoena duces tecum served on our representative in February. So, you know, I'm kind of the pro bono in-house counsel for RiseUp, and so we discussed the matter and decided that the information being requested, which was essentially the subscriber information for several RiseUp users, was identity information that's protected by longstanding precedent here in the Western District of Washington, going back to 2001, case Doe versus ToTheMark.com, which was a published decision holding that you have a right to speak anonymously on the Internet back in the time when this was still a very kind of cutting-edge issue. So this is now 10 years later, and you know, basically the subpoena totally failed to comply with the requirements of the law under the First Amendment and also under the precedent decisions here in the Western District of Washington. So we wrote them a letter objecting to the subpoena under Rule 45 and telling them that, you know, basically you haven't complied with the First Amendment and you need to do so, and until you do so, we're not going to respond. And they responded with a letter of their own, falsely claiming that we were in contempt of court by failing to respond to the subpoena. I'm not sure if they were not familiar with Rule 45, but party receiving a subpoena is only obligated to either produce the records, file a motion to quash, or file a written objection with the serving party. And we had taken the latter course, and that is the extent of your obligations if you receive a subpoena. So they obviously weren't aware of that and said that, oh, we're in contempt and that we were going to be given sanctions and all this stuff. So we wrote them back again and said, well, no, that's not actually right, and you need to comply with the First Amendment. You still haven't done so, so we're not going to comply.
And what does it mean to comply with the First Amendment?
If you want to get identities of, I mean, obviously the First Amendment has its limits, so you can't speak anonymously on the Internet about, threatening to kill people, or there are limits to what you can do. Well, actually, there was a recent Ninth Circuit case saying that you could do just that, actually. So this just came out like last week. There was a case of the gentleman who had posted really racist and inflammatory things after Obama was elected, including, you know, threats on his life. But the Ninth Circuit held that they weren't true threats, and so
that's right.
So it was protected by the First Amendment. This is a very recent case. So, but nonetheless, there are limits. As to what you can do on the Internet.
And political speech is one of the protected classes.
And in this case, the underlying lawsuit in Michigan involved these queer activists who were protesting at a church that was a very conservative church that promoted curing homosexuality and all these other kind of extreme views. The subpoena was purportedly trying to get at the identity of defendants. But one of the caveats to the First Amendment protections is that if you have a bona fide lawsuit and you're trying to uncover the identity of a defendant, there's a whole balancing test the court goes through to establish whether or not you should be able to identify the defendant. They were trying to say that, we're trying to discover parties, but the thing is they didn't provide any evidence to show that these people were at all connected to their lawsuit. They just said, oh, they are. You know, they filed a declaration of counsel saying these people are connected to our lawsuit. But that's not sufficient, and the Doe court in 2001 held that. So that was why they had failed to comply.
Now, Devin, I have a question. I understand that the police came to the church and refused to arrest the protesters.
That's my understanding. Now,
right.
Obviously, I wasn't there, so I don't know exactly what happened. But, yeah, I mean, my understanding from the pleadings in the underlying case is that there was no, the police determined that there was no criminal violation that took place. But they were suing the activists under what's called the Freedom of Access to Clinics Act, ironically,
right.
Which it was enacted to protect people from vitriolic protesters at abortion clinics, but also has a clause protecting people's right to practice their religion.
Right.
And you can't interfere with someone's religious practice. And so that was the hook that the church was using to sue these activists. The activists claimed that they weren't obstructing the church and that they moved when they were told to and various other things.
Has Rise Up received subpoenas in the past to give up membership list?
We have received, to my knowledge, one other subpoena that was given to us by email, which, of course, is not proper service. So, and that subpoena was quickly dealt with because they had not served us properly. So this is the first time that we've been properly served with a subpoena.
I'm actually surprised, given the nature of the clientele of RiseUp.net, that in this political climate, this is the first time this has happened. But proud that RiseUp refused to cave as other telecommunications-related companies.
Yeah, I mean, that was the really interesting thing about this is that they also provided subpoenas to Yahoo and Google, identical subpoenas. And even though, you know, these companies are located in Silicon Valley with very good, you know, federal benches and they're in the Ninth Circuit, it's kind of amazing to me that other companies don't take a stronger stance to protecting their users' privacy. And it's been shown again and again that this is what users like their privacy. So, So you know, Google and Yahoo apparently, I mean, provided the information because they did not have to file any sort of motion against them.
It just tells me how important it is to have lots of independent rise-ups in the world. I mean, rather than, you know, whether it's Google and Yahoo or whether it's PayPal or MasterCard or, you know, whatever these big companies are that are just turning over material without even going to court or challenging it.
That's right. They did file a motion to compel, and we asked for oral argument and got it, and Judge Jones heard oral argument of the case and very quickly, within a week, issued his decision quashing the subpoena. And then we filed for attorney's fees. They didn't see that one coming, I don't think, and we just got that order last week on Thursday, awarding Larry Hildesheim and myself $30,000 in attorney's fees.
It's incredible.
That's
I mean,
fabulous.
Here you can do good work, win on an amazing case, and then get a fee.
And
a
the
fees
bad
on
guys
top.
Will pay your fee.
I love it.
Well, what we're really hoping is that this will serve as both a warning to overly zealous attorneys who are attempting to abuse discovery process, and also that it will really show pro bono attorneys and telecommunications companies that, these subpoenas really can be successfully fought, and that, in fact, you can, if you're a solo practitioner or a pro bono attorney, that you can earn some fees in the process. So, I mean, these cases are, I think, widespread, and people should be taking a stronger stance against them.
It's been really a pleasure to have you on, and we're so thrilled about this victory. So happy that you're doing this kind of good work.
Well, thanks for having me. We hope we don't get any more subpoenas. This is the first and only one.
Exactly. Well, we hope that if we have you on again, it's to celebrate another victory.
Congratulations, Devin.
I hope so.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.